The king was in need of a wife. A new wife, that is. The great Persian ruler of the world had a lovely queen, but she was deposed. She was removed from the royal throne. Tradition says she was beheaded, and actually it was at the bidding of the king. During a lavish week-long party held by the king, the queen dishonored him. And this public disrespect caused the king to be enraged. So his advisors counseled him to address it firmly and finally and to have her removed. She was to come no more into the presence of the king. So he removed her, perhaps reluctantly. So there was a vacancy. Help wanted. The king needed a new queen. Through incredible circumstances, the opening in the throne would be filled by an unlikely woman. She was unlikely because she was a peasant girl who was a captive foreigner in the great Persian Empire. Also, she was an orphan, and she was a Jewess. Her name is Hadassah, but we know her by the name Esther. How did she get to be queen? And what does that have to do with us? We will look at her story in the Old Testament this morning. Please turn there with me if you haven't already. Today is our first Sunday back from our vacation. That is the Calloway family. We were on the road for the past few weeks. We drove approximately 1,000 miles up and down the Golden State. We went from down in the valley up to the mountains, from the Southern California beaches to the San Francisco Bay. It was a busy trip. Looking back, we can tell that rest was not our goal. I was able to work on my pastor's tan, so that was good. But we are grateful to have time with family as well as being with, as a family, but as well as being with our family and friends. I want to thank those men who preached in my absence. My brother-in-law, Dave Torres, was here on July 6th, and also Josh Taylor preached to you last Sunday. So thankful for those men to fill the pulpit, and I know for a fact that you were well fed by those dear brothers through the ministry of the word. For the past 2 months, and while on vacation, I've been reading the book of Esther during our times of family worship. Esther's a fascinating story. It is my wife's favorite book, as well as my mother-in-law's favorite book of the Bible. Chuck Swindoll has said of this 10-chapter book, the story has all the ingredients of the traditional short story: a dramatic beginning, a suspenseful plot, a villain, a hero, a damsel in distress, and a surprising twist of events that leads to a climax where right triumphs over wrong and everybody lives happily ever after, end quote. The plot of the story in Esther revolves around the fact that the Jewish people are in exile and on the brink of extinction. There's an edict that is signed by the Persian king sent to the entire world that called for genocide of the Jews. Every Jew was to be destroyed, killed, and annihilated, both young and old, women and children, in one day. And Esther, the orphan girl, was elevated to the royal throne for just such a time as this. When the opportunity came, she courageously used her influence to save the Jewish race from genocide. Now, the Jewish race is important because they are God's people, but also the Jewish race is important because the Messiah was to come through the Jews. So if you have no Jews, then you have no Messiah. So that's the story of Esther, how God used this woman, this unlikely woman, to save the Jewish people from extinction. The most amazing part about this utterly amazing story is the fact that it nowhere mentions in the book the name of God. Neither Esther nor the Song of Solomon actually mention the name of God in their books. At this time of writing, King Ahasuerus was the king. His name is mentioned 175 times, but God's name, not even one time. Does that strike you? What does that mean to say that we have a book of the Bible where God's name is not even mentioned, where a story plays out where we don't even find his name uttered? Does this mean that God is not there? Does this mean that God was absent? Does this mean that God left the scene to unfold as it would according to the will and whim of the wind? Does that mean that blind chance was guiding the story? Does that mean that karma was at work here? No, it doesn't. God is not absent. God, in fact, is the main character in the story of Esther. He's the one that ensures that every action takes place and every action moves towards its intended goal. Thus, the book of Esther teaches us the sovereignty of God, we should say the silent sovereignty of God, at work in the world and in our lives. Sometimes God seems to be hidden in our lives. It feels as though God is absent, or maybe God is unconcerned, or God is maybe preoccupied with other bigger things rather than our lives. The story of Esther shows us otherwise. We sung the words penned by the Scottish preacher Walter Chalmers Smith, who wrote what we sung this morning: immortal, invisible, God only wise, in light inaccessible, hid from our eyes, most blessed, most glorious, the Ancient of Days, almighty, victorious, his great name we praise. How many children have ever asked you, can we see God? The answer is no. God is a spirit. God is invisible. We cannot see God. Sometimes in the scriptures, there are miracles where waters part or waters are walked on or axe heads float or bread is multiplied. And there are miraculous events that take place that clearly show God. But in the book of Esther, much like in your life, you don't see these extravagant miracles taking place. You just see sort of a humdrum life moving along. And perhaps you can think that God is not there, God is not involved. Perhaps you even think that your life has just been moving along through a series of random coincidences. Well, Esther shows us that is not the case. Esther shows us that the things that occur in world history, the things that occur in your life, are the overarching hand of God's hidden providence, his silent sovereignty. That God is behind the scene, working to bring about his glory and the good of his people. I read this book with my family because I believed we could use the reminder that God is at work behind the scenes, whether we realize it or not. And therefore, he is worthy of our trust and our confidence through the twists and the turns and the plot changes and things that go on in our own lives. We needed this, and I think you need it too. You need a vision of the invisible God. You need to know that God is at work. You need to know, as Romans 8:28 says, God works all things to the good of those who love him. So we're going to look at Esther this morning. We're going to walk through the story. And I want to reveal to you the hidden sovereignty of God at work in this story. Go to chapter 1 if you're not there. Chapter 1 tells us, verse 1, now it took place in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. So this king who is ruling, he is the leader of the Medo-Persian Empire. Remember, you have the Assyrians, then you have the Babylonians, then you have the Medes and the Persians, and then will come the Greeks, and then will come the Romans. Well, this is in that period of history where the Medes and the Persians were enjoying their short-lived reign of world domination. So there's Ahasuerus, and he has a kingdom that is 127 provinces. Not sure how big the provinces are, but he rules from Asia to Africa, from India to Ethiopia. It was estimated that there were 50 million inhabitants in the Medo-Persian Empire. The first chapter tells us that the king had a party, two parties, in fact. One of those parties was 180 days long, and he was showing all his glory. He was showing everything, all of his money, all of his wealth, all of his riches. He was showing this off. But then he had a second party that was just 7 days long. And it was at the second party that he decided, maybe in a drunken stupor, I don't know, he decided that he would bring his queen, Queen Vashti, who was having a party of her own, he would bring her to this party and show her off. Well, the queen, Vashti, she declined. She didn't want to be shown off. She was a beautiful woman, and so she said, perhaps I don't want to be shown off into these other drunken men and my drunken husband or whatever. So she declines to go. She refuses. That presents a problem for the king, because now you have the king who's supposed to rule 50 million people, but he can't even take care of his own house. So his advisors say she's got to go. Doesn't say specifically that she was executed. Tradition says she was beheaded. I don't know what else would happen to her if she's deposed and just left, I don't know, exiled or something perhaps. But she's got to be removed. So then you move into chapter 2, which is approximately 4 years later after that happened. And his advisors, again, have a good idea, and they think that they should hold a beauty contest to find the next Miss Persia, because the king needs a new queen. So if you notice in chapter 2, verse 2, it says, then the king's attendants who served him said, let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king, and let the king appoint overseers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather every beautiful young virgin in Susa, the capital, to the harem, into the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women, and let their cosmetics be given them. Then let the young lady who pleases the king be queen in place of Vashti. And the matter pleased the king, and he did accordingly. So the king hears this counsel, and he says, oh, this is a good idea. Yeah, why don't you go to everywhere in my kingdom, and if there's 50 million, we can say there's 25 million women, and then less of them would have been virgins and so on. Yeah, bring them here, and let me find the most beautiful one. This is not about wisdom. This is not about helpfulness. This is about just finding Miss Persia. So he thinks this is a good idea. So then they go out and they bring the women in. And the women were to come in and they were to spend 12 months in beauty treatments. That's a long time. Sometimes we think our wives take some time getting ready in the morning. How about 12 months? 1 year getting ready. It says they were supposed to perfume themselves with oil and with myrrh, one for 6 months, another for the other 6 months, and they were to get ready. And then each woman would be given her turn for a night with the king. And when she had a night with the king, she could come and bring whatever she wanted to bring in there with her introduction to the king to spend a night with him as he sought to find the best new queen. So that's the setup. That's what's going on. And then in verse 5, we're introduced to Mordecai and Esther. It says in verse 5, now there was a Jew in Susa, the capital whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jer, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjaminite. Verse 6 says, who had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the captives who had been exiled with Jeconiah, the king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had exiled. So some years before, the Babylonian Empire, they were in charge, and Nebuchadnezzar came into the southern kingdom, because that was the only one left, because the Assyrians already conquered the northern kingdom of Israel. The Babylonians come into the southern kingdom of Judah, and they attack the city over years and years of time, and they destroy it, and then they take captives with them back to Babylon. That's Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, those guys. Then they're overturned, the Babylonians are, the Medes and the Persians are now in power. And then you have a man named Mordecai. And he's living in exile in that distant land. Maybe he was born in exile. But he's a captive man. Then it says in verse 7, and he was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther. Esther is her Persian name. Hadassah is her Hebrew name. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. Now the young lady was beautiful of form and face, and when her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So Mordecai is actually Esther's cousin. Maybe they're 15 years apart in age. But he raises this girl, Esther, after her parents die. She's an orphan girl being raised by her cousin, sometimes referred to as her uncle. So she's a part of the kingdom, and she is a virgin, so she's entered into this beauty contest. And if you notice there in verse 15, it says, now in the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter, came to go into the king, she did not request anything except what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the women, advised. And Esther found favor in the eyes of all who saw her. So Esther gets to go in, and she found favor with Haggai. He thought, she's beautiful, and we like her, and she is the one who should be the next queen. Perhaps there's a little influence going on there. And so he says, here's what you need to do. Here's what you need to bring in, or here's what's not to bring in, or whatever it was. So she finds favor with them, and then she goes in to see the king. And then it says in verse 16, so Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus to his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. Verse 17, and the king loved Esther more than all the women. And she found favor and kindness with him more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave her a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his princes and his servants. He also made a holiday for all the provinces and gave gifts according to the king's bounty. Look at verse 20. Esther had not yet made known her kindred or her people, even as Mordecai had commanded her, for Esther did what Mordecai told her, as she had done when under his care. So Esther wins the beauty contest. She's taken in. She finds favor with the king. She replaces Queen Vashti. Now we know the king likes parties. He has a party. He has a feast. It's Esther's feast. He gives a great banquet. But the text tells us very clearly that Esther doesn't tell anybody yet that she's a Jew. Remember, people came, women came from all over the world at that time, so you wouldn't necessarily guess that she's a Jew, but she is Jewish. That's hidden at this time. So she's there in the royal palace, and Mordecai, he sits by the king's gate. He's raised her. He loves her. He wants to know what's going on with her. So he keeps an eye on her, keeps an ear out for what's going on. And as he's sitting by the king's gate, he overhears something very important. Look at verse 21. It says, in those days, while Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh. Sound like thugs, don't they? Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's officials from those who guarded the door, so these are security guards, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So they're hatching a plot to assassinate the king. Verse 22. But the plot became known to Mordecai, and he told Queen Esther. And Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. Verse 23. Now when the plot was investigated and found to be so, they were both hanged on a gallows. And it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the king's presence. So Mordecai just happens to be there, and just at the right time, he just happens to overhear these thugs saying, hey, when he goes out there, let's get the thing, and let's off him. And then he tells Queen Esther, and Queen Esther tells the king, and the king hears that this guy Mordecai saved his life. So he says, we better write this down. And what sounds like very pedestrian, very boring. The end of verse 23, this was written in the book of the Chronicles in the king's presence. Sounds like exciting stuff there. book of the Kings chronicled. Mordecai saved your life. Hold on to that. Now in chapter 3, we meet another character in the story. His name is Haman. Verse 1 says, after these events, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, and advanced him and established his authority over all the princes who were with him. So Haman is a wealthy man. He's an influential officer in the court, and it tells us that he is an Agagite. You know what an Agagite is? It's a son of Agag. Well, do you know who Agag was? Agag was a king of the Amalekites. The Amalekites were the people who, one of the people, who when the Israelites were leaving Egypt, about to go into the promised land, they attacked the Israelites. So God said, we're going to destroy the Amalekites. When you get into the land, you're going to destroy them. It says that in Deuteronomy 25. Then you go to 1 Samuel 15, and Samuel tells Saul, the king, what you need to do is attack the Amalekites and King Agag. Saul fails to do that. Samuel finishes the job, and the text says that Samuel hacked Agag to pieces, just as the Lord had commanded. So here's a descendant of those people, the Agagites or the Amalekites. And so we know already this guy, he is an enemy of the Jews. So it says in verse 2, and all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage. How do you think that made Haman feel? Haman got the king to tell everybody to bow down to Haman when he walks by. But here's a guy, Mordecai, who doesn't do it. That's where we use the phrase that stuck in his craw, that got in his gourd. Verse 4 says, now it was when they had spoken daily to him, that is Mordecai, and he wouldn't listen to them, they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's reason would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. So the rest of the guys who are bowing to Haman, they're like, Haman, this guy doesn't bow. His name's Mordecai. Why doesn't he bow? Well, I don't know, but he's a Jew. Haman says, wait a minute, I know the Jews. I know them. Verse 5, when Haman saw that Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage to him, Haman was filled with rage. He was angry. Verse 6 says, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him who the people of Mordecai were. Therefore, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. So Haman that says, okay, I don't want to just get rid of Mordecai. We're going to get rid of the Jews. Vengeance. So then Haman goes to King Ahasuerus and he says, hey, king, there's some people in your realm and they don't follow your laws. And that's not good for your kingdom. So here's what we should do. I think we should take out these people, these pesky people. I mean, who are the Jews anyway? He doesn't mention that they're Jews, but Ahasuerus has conquered the world, so there's all kinds of people out there. So he's like, oh, there's some people, they're kind of pesky. So Ahasuerus says, oh, good idea. So it says there in verse 10 of chapter 3, then he took his signet ring from his hand, that's the king, and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. The text is really showing us, here's who this guy is, his history, but also here's his hatred. So he comes up with this idea, tells the king, and the king, as it were, hands him his auto pen. Just go ahead, make an edict. Good idea. Haman also says, we'll pay you and all this, we'll add to your treasury. He says, okay, great, this is a good thing. So then it says in verse 13, and letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews. I mean, that's three ways of kind of saying the same thing. Like, they're decimated. And then it says, both young and old, women and children, in one day. Verse 14, a copy of the edict to be issued as a law in every province was published to all the peoples so that they should be ready for this day. The couriers went out impelled by the king's command, while the decree was issued in Susa, the capital, and while the king and Haman sat down to drink, the city of Susa was in confusion. All of a sudden, an edict comes out, says, oh, hey, guess what? Coming up in a number of months, maybe 8-9 months from now, you can kill this people and take them all out. Women, children, everybody. They're in the palace, sipping their wine, and everybody else is confused. What in the world's going on? So a plan has been hatched to execute God's people. It has to be stopped. So as we start chapter 4, there is an imperial death warrant hanging over the people, and Mordecai hears about it, and he weeps, and he puts on sackcloth. It says in verse 3, and in each and every province where the command and decree of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews with fasting, weeping, and wailing, and many lay on sackcloth and ashes. This is an empire-wide time of mourning for God's people. And Mordecai's there in the capital city right next to the palace, and he's wearing sackcloth and ashes, and he's sitting by the king's gate. And Esther finds out that he's doing this, and she doesn't understand why, and she apparently can't directly talk to him, so she finds this man, one of the king's men named Hathach. And she starts talking to Hathach and say, get him some new clothes. He refuses the new clothes. It says in verse 6, so Hathach went out to Mordecai to the city square in front of the king's gate, and Mordecai told him all that had happened to him and the exact amount of money that Haman had promised to pay the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. So there's the money involved. Verse 8, he also gave him a copy of the text of the edict which had been issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show Esther and inform her and order her to go into the king and implore his favor to plead with him for her people. So Mordecai says, you're there, you're queen. Take all these things, Hathach. Tell Esther she's got to go to the king and she's got to stop this. He's got to stop this. Well, that's problematic. It's not an easy thing to do just to go into the king. Hathach then takes the message back to, came back and related Mordecai's words to Esther. Verse 11, Esther says this, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that for any man or woman who comes to the king, to the inner court, who is not summoned, he has but one law, that he be put to death, unless the king holds out to him the golden scepter so that he may live. And I've not been summoned to come to the king for these 30 days. So Esther says, hey, great, that's a nice idea, but if you go to the king and he hasn't called you, he's got one law. He'll kill you. Unless he holds out his golden scepter, and then you touch the golden scepter and you can approach the king. Now, I would take this very seriously if I were Esther. This is ironic that Vashti was bidden by the king but didn't come and was kicked out. Esther is not bidden by the king, but she wants to go see the king. And in so doing, she'll take her life into her own hands. Well, Mordecai replies back, verse 13. He says, do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews. Verse 14. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this? Mordecai says, consider the time. Consider where you are. And it's interesting. I think he expresses faith here. He says, relief and deliverance will arise from the Jews from somewhere else. I think the implication is God will save his people. And he says, but hey, you're going to perish. Your father's house will perish. But who knows if you're there for such a time as this, Esther. So Esther hears this and she reports back and she says this in verse 16. Go, assemble all the Jews who are found in Susa, and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maidens also will fast in the same way. And thus I will go to the king, which is not according to the law. And if I perish, I perish. Whew. Wow. She says, all right, I'll do it. But prepare a fast. When the Jews fast, they pray. So she's saying, do this for 3 days, and then I'll go in, and if I die, I die. That's courage from this young woman. So then chapter 5. Came about on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's rooms. The king was sitting on his royal throne in the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. Verse 2, and it happened that when the king saw Esther, the queen, standing in the court, she obtained favor in his sight. And the king extended to Esther the golden scepter which was in his hand. So Esther came near and touched the top of the scepter. So she enters into the palace, and he's sitting there, probably real far off, probably real high ceiling. And she comes walking in, and he's looking, probably stroking his chin. Oh, yeah, it's been a month since I've seen this fine young woman. She comes, takes a scepter, and puts it out. Maybe she wipes some sweat, I don't know. She comes and touches it. Verse 3, the king said to her, what's troubling you? Queen Esther, title there. And what is your request? Even to half of the kingdom, it will be given to you. Whatever you want, I'll give it to you. So Esther, with wisdom and tact, she says in verse 4, if it please the king, may the king and Haman come this day to the banquet that I have prepared for him. So Esther has a banquet. She wants the king to come, also Haman, the Agagite. He's got to come too. Verse 5, king likes parties. Bring Haman quickly, that we may do as Esther desires. So the king and Haman came to the banquet, which Esther had prepared. Verse 6, and as they drank their wine at the banquet, the king said to Esther, what is your petition? For it shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Even to the half of the kingdom, it shall be done. Come on, tell me, what do you want? But Esther's wise, and she's tactful. It says in verse 7, my petition and my request is, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my petition and do what I request, may the king and Haman come to the banquet which I shall prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king says. So she says, come to the banquet with Haman. They're at the banquet. Haman's there. Okay, what do you want to ask? She says, well, come back tomorrow. I'll have another banquet. And bring Haman too. I bet the king enjoys the suspense. Haman was feeling pretty self-important here as well. It says in verse 9, then Haman went out that day, glad and pleased of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, and that he did not stand up or tremble before him, Haman was filled with anger against Mordecai. He's ticked off. He just had a special dinner in the palace with just him and the king and the queen. And as he's floating home, everybody's bowing to him except for one man, Mordecai. And he's absolutely enraged. When he goes home, he calls all his friends and calls his wife, and he says, guess what? I had lunch with the king and the queen, just me and just them. It was great, except for one thing. Mordecai didn't bow. He says in verse 13, all of this does not satisfy me every time I see Mordecai sitting at the king's gate. Mordecai the Jew. Verse 14, his wife has a good idea. Her name is Zeresh. Here's an idea. Have a gallows 50 cubits high made, and in the morning ask the king to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go joyfully with the king to the banquet. The advice pleased Haman so that he had gallows made. So you got to get rid of Mordecai. So why don't you make a gallows? It says it's 50 cubits high. That's 7 stories tall. Make this huge gallows, and tomorrow morning, first thing, go see the king and say, hey, can I put him on it? The king's certainly going to hand over his auto pen to you, and it's going to happen just as you see fit. So he's like, great. And he probably slept really well. But the king didn't sleep well. Look at the next chapter. Verse 1, chapter 6. During that night, the king could not sleep. He has insomnia. So he gave an order to bring the book of records, the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. Remember that book we heard about at the end of, was it chapter 2? Bring that book, the Chronicles. MacArthur said this is probably like reading the phone book. But he wants it read. Maybe he thinks it'll help him fall asleep. I don't know. Verse 2, it says, and it was found written what Mordecai had reported concerning Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who were doorkeepers, that they had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. Oh! There's a story. One day Mordecai told the queen Esther, and then she told you about Bigthan and Teresh, and they wanted to kill you. And so they were executed, and Mordecai saved your life. So the king started thinking, wait a minute. What did we do to honor Mordecai? So he says in verse 3, what honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? Then the king's servants who attended him said, nothing has been done for him. Now you could say, I don't know how many years ago this was in relation, but you could say, you know what, you're alive, it's old hat, who is this guy? Does it really matter if you send him a fruit basket at Christmas? I mean, big deal. Well, if you're the king, you want to deal swiftly who might want to assassinate you. And you want to deal lavishly and overabundant generosity with those who spare your life. So you cannot let Mordecai go unrewarded. You've got to reward Mordecai. So then, early in the morning, the king said, who is in the court? Because he's got to have someone do his bidding here. This guy's just the reader. Who's there that's going to make this happen? Then verse 4 says, now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace in order to speak to the king about hanging Mordecai on the gallows which he had prepared for him. I think Haman slept well, but he also got up early. He rushes to the palace where the king couldn't sleep, and he is just antsy and just can't wait to get out. Hey, I've got this guy Mordecai. I built this gallows. Can we put him on it? But before Haman can get those words out. It says in verse 5, the king said, let him come in. Verse 6, so Haman came in and the king said to him. Haman has no idea the context. It's earlier in the morning. He doesn't know he didn't sleep, whatever. But he's waiting to give his thoughts, give his idea. The king said to him, what is to be done for the man whom the king desires to honor? That's general. That's nonspecific. Haman, you're an advisor of mine. When the king wants to honor a man, what should he do for that man? Well, Haman, still reflecting on his image in the mirror that morning, says, huh, who would the king want to honor more than me? It's what it says at the end of verse 6. So, verse 7, he says to the king, well, for the man, whoever that is, that the king desires to honor, verse 8, let him bring a royal robe, which the king has worn even, and the horse on which the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown has been placed. And let the robe and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble princes, and let them array the man, whoever he is, whom the king desires to honor, and lead him on horseback through the city square and proclaim before him, thus it shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor. Haman thinks he's drawing up what the king is about to do for him. But you and I know that the king couldn't sleep and read the Chronicles and heard about Mordecai and wants to honor Mordecai. So verse 10, then the king said to Haman, take quickly the robes and the horse you have said, the smile growing larger on Haman's face here, and do so for Mordecai. The text says, the Jew who was sitting at the king's gate, do not fall short in anything of all that you have said. Or another way to put it is, make sure this happens and happens pronto, and would you shout loudly as you honor Mordecai for sparing my life? Go ahead. Go for it. Verse 11, so Haman took the robe and the horse and arrayed Mordecai and led him on horseback through the city square and proclaimed before him, thus it shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor. Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate. But Haman, where's he going to go? He returns home, hurried home, mourning with his head covered. He was absolutely humiliated. The exact opposite of what he wanted to happen basically has happened. Mordecai was not killed. Mordecai was honored. So he talks to his wife, Zeresh. She's got an idea. Actually, she has a word of warning. Verse 13, Haman recounted to Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and Zeresh, his wife, said to him, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish origin, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. Now, why didn't you say that yesterday? This is like, you're on your own, pal. You're going down if he's Jew. Verse 14, while they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hastily brought Haman to the banquet which Esther had prepared. So in the middle of his speaking there, the author's telling us, all this is chaos is here. Hey, if he's a Jew, you're going down. And then the eunuchs, knock, 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 eunuchs here. Oh, next party, okay, go. Save your tears for another day because you've got a second party to go to. Maybe this will cheer you up. So he goes to the second party. The king says, okay, what's your petition, Queen Esther? It should be granted you. What is your request? Even to half of the kingdom, it shall be done. Verse 3, then Queen Esther answered and said, and watch how she builds to what she's asking. It says, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me as my petition, and my people as my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Now, if we had been sold as slaves, men and women, I would have remained silent, for the trouble would not be commensurate with the annoyance to the king. So she's saying, hey, we're supposed to be destroyed here, I and my people. So would you do something about this? Well, the king hears about it, verse 5, and he asks Queen Esther, who is he? Where is he? Who would presume to do thus? Because this is an act of treason. You want to kill the queen? That's treasonous. So where is this guy? Tell me his name. Who is he? Verse 6. Watch the buildup again. And Esther said, a foe and an enemy is this wicked Haman. Boom. Then Haman became terrified before the king and queen. Uh-oh, he knows. His face is turning red. Sweat is beading on his forehead. The king gets up. He goes for a walk in the garden palace, leaves the room. While he leaves and goes to the garden and walks around, Haman comes over to Queen Esther to plead for his life. Save me, spare me. I didn't know, and how do I know? Spare my life. And as he's going, he falls on the couch that Esther is sitting on. And it says in verse 8, now when the king returned from the palace garden into the place where they were drinking wine, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. Then the king said, because think of how that looks. Will he, that is Haman, even assault the queen with me in the house? As the word went out of the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. It's over, pal. Don't touch the queen. But I look at verse 9. There was a eunuch who knew about what was going on, and he made a suggestion, and his name is Harbona. Verse 9. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs who were before the king, said, behold, indeed the gallows standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on behalf of the king. That might be a good way to execute him. And the king said, hang him on it. That is a complete reversal of what Haman intended for those gallows. Verse 10, so they hanged Haman on the gallows which he had prepared for Mordecai. And the king's anger subsided. C&R clothiers used to say, what a difference a day makes. Chapter 8, on that day, King Ahasuerus gave the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, to Queen Esther. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had disclosed what he was to her. And the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken away from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. Wow. So King Ahasuerus gives all everything that Haman had to Esther. Esther passes it on to Mordecai. So he has charge of it. But then also, the king takes the signet ring, the auto pen from Haman, and hands it over to Mordecai. Verse 3, then Esther spoke again to the king, fell at his feet, wept, and implored him to avert the evil scheme of Haman, the Agagite, and his plot, which he devised against the Jews. So, okay, the threat is still there. Haman might be done away with, but hey, there's still this edict throughout all the 50 million inhabitants that on this certain day, you need to kill all the Jews. So everybody's getting ready to do this. The Jews are freaking out, you know. So we have to change this. What are we going to do? Well, you can't revoke a law of the Medes and the Persians. They always stay. So what needs to happen is they make a new law. And then it says in verse 11, chapter 8, here's this new law. In them, the king granted the Jews who were in each and every city the right to assemble and to defend their lives, to destroy, to kill, and annihilate the entire army of any people or province which might attack them, including children and women, and to plunder their spoil on one day in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, the 13th day of the 12th month, that is in the month of Adar. So the 12th of Adar, or was it the 13th day of Adar, was the day that the Jews were supposed to be annihilated, but they made a new edict that the Jews can assemble and the Jews can defend themselves on that same day, the 13th of the 12th month. Mordecai went out from the presence of the king, verse 15, in royal robes of blue and white, no more sackcloth for him, with a large crown of gold and a garment of fine linen and purple. And the city of Susa shouted and rejoiced. For the Jews there was light and gladness and joy and honor. And in each and every province, in each and every city where the king's commandment and his decree arrived, there was gladness and joy for the Jews, a feast and a holiday. And many among the peoples of the land became Jews, for the dread of the Jews had fallen on them. In chapter 9, we see that that day comes, and the Jews actually do take vengeance on their enemies. And they overcome their enemies. And so Mordecai and Esther send out another decree that says that this day is now going to be a holiday. This is going to be a celebration of God's rescue of his people. And you need to recognize this every year, and your children need to recognize it every year, all to the ends of the generations, recognizing this as a special day of God's deliverance. So they went from a time of horror to a holiday. Near annihilation to joyous celebration. How did this all happen? The name of God is not mentioned once in this story. How did this all take place? Well, it's undeniable that God's overwhelming hand of providence was at work. His hand of providence was at work in the downfall of Vashti and the setting up of this beauty contest. His silent sovereignty was at work when Esther was the one who was chosen to be the next queen. His silent sovereignty was at work when Mordecai, at just the right time, happened to overhear the plot against the king. And then at just the right time, the king has insomnia. And then, according to God's silent sovereignty, Haman just so happens to enter the palace at the moment Ahasuerus is wondering how to reward Mordecai. And then at just the right time, after Esther has already revealed that Haman is the guy who wants to wipe out her and her people, that the king returns. And then it's according to God's silent sovereignty that Haman is hanged on the very gallows that he built for Mordecai. And it's because of God that the Jews are saved from annihilation and take vengeance on their enemies. And this amazing chain of events occurs, which reveals the immortal, invisible God. Esther's an incredible story, and we enjoy it for its twists and turns and the ultimate triumph of God over evil. But I think what we like about Esther is this. This is what life actually feels like for you and for me. Just like our lives, God is at work, but we don't sometimes see him at work. Often his hand is hidden from us. Sometimes we might see it after the fact, or maybe we won't see it until we are with God in heaven. But sometimes on this journey of life, we ask, why is this happening? Or what is God doing here? Esther reminds us that though we don't read God's name in the book, as Chuck Swindoll said, it's there in invisible ink. Esther helps us see the immortal, invisible, the God who is wise, the God who wisely orchestrates events in world history and events in the lives of his children to bring about his good purposes. Esther reveals the silent sovereignty of God at work. We may not know what God is doing, but we know that God is doing. And so therefore, we can trust him. The life of the believer in Christ is hemmed in behind and before. There is a divine conductor orchestrating the events of your life for God's glory and for your glory and ultimate good. There may be no greater example of the truth of Romans 8:28 than the book of Esther. God causes all things to work together for the good of those who love him, who are called according to his purpose. As one poet said, there is an arm that holds me up, an eye that kindly watches my path. One man said, hope exists because God exists and cares for his people. This is true for you if you are in Christ. If you have a trusting, saving relationship with Christ based on faith in Christ's death and resurrection, you have this God as your Father. And I say this to you, you don't want to just be on God's side so you can get great things. You want to be on God's side so you don't get God's judgment, which you deserve, and you get his great things. Paul says in Romans chapter 8, he who did not spare his own son, will he not also freely with that give you all things? Give you his protection, give you his care. But again, friend, it doesn't always feel like this is happening in our lives. Things are confusing. Things are happening in ways that we didn't plan or intend or desire. Yet still, how do we respond? Trust. Trust in God. As Spurgeon said so well, God is too good to be unkind, and he is too wise to be mistaken. And when we cannot trace his hand, we must trust his heart. We must, brothers and sisters. His glory and your life, in your life and your joy in him is dependent upon that. Let me pray. Father in heaven, we bless you that you are the immortal, the invisible, the God only wise, who is wisely acting and working for the good of your people. Maybe not the temporary good. Maybe not the possessions or the wealth or things like that. But you work for the good of your people in that you will always deliver them. As Jesus, you prayed or taught us to pray, deliver us from the evil one. Oh God and Father, you are good, and everything you do is right. All your ways are good. Help us to trust you in the confusion, the chaos perhaps, and the difficulties of our personal lives and what we see even in the broader culture. And we ask that you would come soon. Bring your Son to set all things right, and so that your Son, King Jesus, might reign upon this earth in a reign of righteousness. May all who hear these words humbly bow today and not reject him, but humbly bow today before they are forced to bow someday. In the name of King Jesus, we pray. Amen.